Thank you so much for joining us. I know you have a very busy schedule and you know, a lot on your plate. Are you in are you in Tanzania right now?
No, I've been visiting Israel for the last week. I did a seminar about my project in Africa, and it was very well received by the homeopaths, and they were great at raising contributions to help us.
Fantastic.
Because we survive on that, and then I'm going back in a couple of days back to Africa.
Okay, fantastic. Well, yeah. Let me, for those of you, I'm sure most people are already very familiar with Jeremy Sharon and his work, but for those of you who maybe are still new to homeopathy and have not yet, don't know that much about Jeremy, let me give him a quick introduction. So basically, Jeremy has been practicing homeopathy for what, more than 27, 28 years now, Jeremy, something like that?
It'll be 30 in September.
30 in September. So, and Jeremy began his formal studies at the College of Homeopathy in London in 1980. He also
I must be getting old, Shakimi, for 30 years.
30 years. Right. He also completed a degree simultaneously in acupuncture at the International College of Oriental Medicine, though he has practiced homeopathy exclusively since 1982. His knowledge of Chinese medicine always comes through in his classes. If you've ever participated in any of Jeremy's courses, his Dynamis course, or any of the seminars that he offers, you'll always see him interjecting concepts and ideas from Chinese medicine. Mr. Sher began teaching while still in college. He taught in most of the British schools, and he began the Dynamis School in 1987. This is the longest-running postgraduate course in the United Kingdom. He's taught the Dynamis curriculum throughout Europe and North America. He's an extremely popular international lecturer, and he also maintains a very busy practice in London, Israel, really all over the world. And Jeremy, for those of you who don't know, was really the first to redevelop the science and art of provings, literally after a century of almost complete non-discussion of the whole subject, and it's one of the center points of homeopathy. And in 1982, he conducted his first proving of scorpion, and has since then, I don't know, Jeremy, how many provings are you up to now?
I think it's about 34.
34. Okay, so 34. I would say probably more than any other living homeopath. He's conducted more contemporary provings than any other individual. And he also wrote a very excellent book called The Dynamics and Methodology of Homeopathic Provings, which has essentially become a standard textbook in most colleges and institutions which offer homeopathic courses around the world. Now, more recently, Jeremy has been involved in a fantastic project in Tanzania, working with the indigenous populations there, specifically focusing on the problem of AIDS. And hopefully he can tell us a little bit more about that. So that's kind of the superficial overview of Jeremy's involvement in homeopathy. But let me just say, on a personal level, I've known Jeremy for many years, and he's really one of the finest practitioners and educators that we have in our community, and somebody who really has the ability to take very complex ideas in homeopathy and make them accessible and easily understandable to a very large part of the homeopathic community. So, Jeremy, thank you again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
My pleasure, Kim. Always nice to talk to you and our friends.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't mention that. Jeremy's a good friend of mine as well. All right, so, Jeremy, the title of today's course is Tips on Case Analysis. You know, let's just start from the very beginning. Why do you feel that we need case analysis? What's that all about?
Well, you see, there's two ways to approach a case, really, Kim. One is looking for the remedy and taking the case with the remedy in front of your eyes, so that with every question you ask, with every bit of information you get, you are thinking, what remedy can this be, or maybe some other methodology, what does that fit into, what kind of box can we fit that into out of our knowledge. But the way I see it, it's much more correct and will lead to a bigger success to understand the patient first. If we go by what Hahnemann says in paragraph 3, he says, you know, first of all, if you can perceive what needs to be cured in every case, and only afterwards perceive what's curative in materia medica and match one to the other. Because once we obviously, as we all know as homeopaths, you know, Hahnemann's prerequisite is freedom from prejudice. And that's a big subject that can be thought upon, meditated upon, and, you know, it's something that we develop the whole of our life. But when we take a case and we have the materia medica in front of us and the patient behind that, so we're seeing the patient through materia medica or through any system, never mind what system, to my mind we are already prejudiced because we're coming with a concept to the patient rather than seeing the patient for what they are. So the way I like to practice homeopathy is to try and understand the patient and try and understand exactly that which has to be cured by them, try and see what holds the totality together, what makes the meaningful whole, and not just a bunch of symptoms that are tied together that could be keynotes or anything else. And only once we perceive that case from the physical externals to the mentals, emotionals, generals, and seen it as one meaningful whole, that means that we can connect all those symptoms together and see the core of what needs to be cured. Only at that point do I go to repertory, materia medica, or any other system of practice to find out what will match that in our materia medica. And I feel that's a way that is more free of prejudice. Now, to achieve that, we have to be able, that comprehension of a case, we have to be able to analyze the case, to break it down into components, and to see how all those components later on fit together. So in essence, I would say it's just analysis of the case is only half the formula. We have two parts. We have analysis and we have a synthesis of the case. Analysis is relatively easy, and that's what you'll hear from you know, a lot of homeopaths when they're working on a case in class, and they'll say, okay, this patient has grief, and they have white spots on the fingernails, and they have desire for salt, and they had problems in their childhood. And that's just mentioning the components and making a list of all these things. And that is relatively easy. You know, there are lots of analysis in various forms. There's political analysis, there's financial analysis, there's, you know, any kind of analysis. Lots of people do that. But there are not many people that do synthesis, meaning the art of and science of bringing all these things together back into one whole. And homeopaths have to be good at that because making a totality and perceiving is rarely about synthesis. So it's two stages. One is the breaking down, and the other is bringing it together into one whole. And when we have that, when we finally synthesize the case, and we can summarize it in one short line that will encompass everything, then we have before our eyes that which has to be cured. And at the next stage, we can go into repertory materia medica and say, what matches that concept? If we go into that work, that repertorizing materia medica or any other system, without a synthesized concept of what needs to be cured, then we'll kind of be lost in the woods, lost in the forest. You know, does the patient have this symptom? Does this symptom match the repertory? Is it in the remedy or not? And really, we're floundering around. Because it's not about matching symptoms, it's about matching a generalized picture to a picture of a remedy. So I like to come to my repertory, come to my materia medica with a very firm concept before I actually start trying to find a remedy. And in that way, you know, I know I'm on solid ground and a less prejudiced ground. Now, you know, there are many, many ways to analyze, many techniques to analyze, and there are many techniques to synthesize. And this takes learning and it takes practice. There are various methodologies, and, you know, we're going to be doing this five-weekend course starting at the end of July, and I hope to go through various of these methodologies of synthesizing a case, of taking all those components and making them into a comprehensive whole. You can learn these techniques. It's, you know, when somebody sees a good homeopath doing that for the first time, bringing the whole case together, it looks like magic, and you know, you think, wow, I could never do that. But I know from a lot of experience of teaching that that is information, that is a technique that can be passed on to students, so you know they can make it their own, and then later develop it in their own particular ways and trends according to what they like and their personality, etc. So there are many methods to do it, and in a way, the ideal synthesis will show the same essence of the case, the same core of the case, looking at it from many different angles. And that's really a beautiful thing when you can pull a case together from different points of view and say, wow, this all fits together, this all makes one sense, and it makes the work later much more certain and much more easy.
Jeremy, you mentioned multiple methods. As you are well aware, there's a plethora of different approaches to homeopathy these days. I mean, it's like, you know, everybody who becomes a teacher has their own way of practicing homeopathy. So there's all these different methods out there. I'm curious, how do you see all these different methods relating to each other? Is it necessary to have all these different methods? And do you feel that there's one, perhaps, ultimate method or way to practice homeopathy, or do you feel that there's different styles and approaches? What's your feeling about this?
Well, I feel, you know, definitely there are different styles and approaches that fit different people, because one of the things in homeopathy is individuality, you know, and we have to respect individuality and that people are different. And I would hate everybody to be clones of my way of teaching, for instance. You know, I don't expect and I don't want people to do that. But I like them, you know, when I teach, I like people to learn what I'm doing, to be able to do it, and then to go and change it in their own way and to bring out their own individuality. So, no, I don't think we need, you know, everybody going the same way. And there are teachers more towards a kind of right-wing, over-classical homeopathic methodologies that want everybody to be practicing the same way. On the other hand, I feel it is paramount that, you know, in these methods, the method doesn't come before the understanding of the case. That means the moment your mindset, it's what I said before, but I think it's really important. The moment your mindset is saying, you know, I'm looking for the remedy through some certain methodology, I think you're going to make mistakes. You know, never mind what methodology it is. As long as you're first understanding the patient, you're safe. But when you're fitting it into a system, you're going to have trouble. Some systems I like more personally, and some systems I like less personally. You know, some buzz for me and some don't buzz for me. But I've tried to master as many as I can and then use them appropriately for each case so that, you know, if we come with one method, you know, like you guys say in America, if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So the moment you're coming with one system and this is your methodology and you're going to use it in every case, you've got a problem, I think, because not every case will fit into that kind of methodology. And then people try and force it into that methodology and you've already got a distortion. So when you have a range of methods that you can use and you let the case choose the method rather than the method choose the case, then you're flowing freely and you're more likely to be accurate because you're not going to have to bend that case to fit into your methodology. Of course, as I said, personally, I have methodologies I like more and methodologies I like less, and, you know, we could address each one separately and you know, analyze them and what their strengths and what their weaknesses are. And that's, you know, we can go there if you want to.
Jeremy, you know, there's so many of these different approaches and methods. For somebody like yourself who's been practicing for almost 30 years and, you know, has obviously a mastery of the subject, I would imagine that your ability to look at different methods and see where they might be useful or not useful probably is a lot easier than for a lot of students or people who are still new to homeopathy. Can you make some suggestions on how we could either integrate or differentiate these different methods? Like, how would somebody who perhaps doesn't have the knowledge base that you have know when or when they shouldn't use a particular approach?
That's a very difficult one, because you see, when you don't have enough knowledge, when you haven't accumulated enough mileage and seen different methodologies in an unprejudiced way, it's difficult to shift. Am I allowed to say bullshit?
Yeah. I'll edit it out later.
It's difficult to shift the bullshit from the gold nuggets.
Mm.
And in many methods that people teach, I see, you know, a lot of bullshit. And then within that bullshit, there are a few gold nuggets that I say, wow, I can use that and I can use that, you know, take that, make it my own, change it into something that works for me. But it takes a critical eye, and I think you need a critical eye in homeopathy and homeopathic methodology, not to swallow anybody's teaching, you know, whole without chewing it up first and examining it and seeing where it works and where it doesn't work. All along the way, we need to have, you know, that critical eye. When we choose a rubric, we need to be very self-critical. When I say critical, I'm not talking about reproaching oneself. I'm talking about, you know, the kind of standard that is taught in a master's course as opposed to in high school or a BA course. The ability to, you know, to look at something and say, does this really work? Does it hold water? Does it make a logical thing? And to be able to make those choices and not to think that any methodology is all good and all bad. You know, if people are using things, in my opinion, you know, there's going to be some good stuff in there, and they're going to be having successes, because overall, you know, homeopaths are intelligent people, and they make their choices, and they have their cases, and they have their feedback, and it works for them. But it's also pretty easy to dupe ourselves and to believe in stuff that is not always working just because it fits our methodology and our one concept. And therefore, the student homeopath has to look at it and say, you know, is it really working? Does it really make sense to me? And does it work for me personally as a person? And to be able to differentiate within one teaching and say, this is not 100% great, and this is not 0%. There's somewhere in the middle of all these methodologies. Some places it fits, some places it doesn't fit, and we should take the best out of it and use that if we can.
Jeremy, a few years back, there was a website, Homeopathic Symposium, which was conducting these kind of live cases where they'd have a master practitioner come in and he would analyze the case and the whole community would look at it and participate in the process. And you actually came in and did one, and I thought it was one of the most cogent and incisive analysis that I had ever heard. It was just absolutely brilliant the way you took the case apart and looked at it from a number of different ways. I was wondering, so people could get a sense of how brilliant you are at taking apart the case and synthesizing the different ideas and themes in it and putting together this one totality, could you kind of give us an example of a case analysis so people get a sense of how you actually do this work?
Wow. Well, I haven't actually prepared anything in this way, but let me...
Just an example of a case analysis, perhaps.
But I'll say, let me give you just one more thing before I give you... I try and go there.
Okay.
You know, I'd say the biggest turning point in my practice, in my 30 years of practice, was when I studied with the Israeli homeopath, Joseph Reeves. And previous to that, I'd studied, you know, with various teachers, Vitulkas and Vasilis Gekas and English teachers. And in my mind, I was all the time, I was trained to take the case and think, what's a remedy, what's a remedy? And after studying with Joseph and coming to a certain realization, I took all the books out of my clinic. I took the repertory out. I didn't have a computer then, of course. But I took the repertory out. I took the materia medica out. I said to myself, I am not going to choose a remedy on the spot ever for another 3 years. I think 3 or 4 years, I did not give any remedy on the spot in the clinic. And it was hard. because, you know, I'd come home and I'd have what was what I called the pile, you know, which literally gave me piles sitting on it, you know, the whole weekend. You know, I'd have this huge pile of cases and I'd go through them and analyze them and think about them. But it's that exercise that gave me ability to break a case apart and put it together. Because I'm repeating myself here, but the moment you're going to look for the remedy and you're going to try and find it, you're going to lose that ability to break it apart and put it together again. So I think that was a turning point for me, really, and it gave me that ability. It exercised those muscles of analysis and synthesize that can be exercised, can be built up. Now you're asking for a case, and I'm trying to kind of pull one from.
Just an example. It doesn't have to be a whole case, but just to show us how you do the work that you do.
Okay. I use, if you talk about methods of analysis, you know, you in a way you can count them by numbers. Because you can divide a case into two, and you can divide it into 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and further. And I'll explain that. If let's say we choose a number 7, okay, and analysis by sevens would be one way of an analysis by sevens would be analysis according to the chakra system. Now you might get a case where a person comes complaining about a sore throat. And at the same time, you see them complaining about an eruption on their neck or a sore neck or something like that. So immediately, you put that together and you say, okay, there's something happening here with the throat chakra. The front of the body and the back of the body always go together. So I would join those two together. And then, of course, we may see later on that there are problems with self-expression. So, or crying easily or something like that. So immediately we put that together, you know, pain in the neck, sore throat, problems with self-expression. Now, that would be a simple stage one analysis. Then we might find another chakra involved. For instance, there might be something in the solar plexus, and we might find some flatulence on one hand, and maybe, again, on the back we might find some lumbar pains, or we might find somebody saying, you know, I hold everything in my stomach, or it's difficult for me to digest this problem. So we'd say, okay, now we have something happening with the throat chakra, something happening with the solar plexus chakra. Now, how do these two relate together? And there's kind of a series in chakras where you say, you know, you have the middle thymus heart chakra, one above that is the throat chakra, one below that is the abdominal chakra. So those two go together, abdominal chakra and throat chakra. So you'd say, okay, I now need a remedy that has those two chakras involved. I have to have a remedy that has throat chakra and has abdominal chakra in all their contexts, mental, emotional, and physical. So that would be, you know, one way to approach it with a certain system, with that number 7.
Mm.
Of course, then we could take something with the number 2 inside that and say, you know, this person has a weepy voice and he's crying all the time, but in their dreams they're happy and they're laughing and they're playing around. So now we say, okay, this is the law of twos, the laws of opposites. So we have sadness, weeping, opposite, laughing and crying. So we arrange that as a twosome. And that twosome might also be blackness of the tongues and white spots on the fingernails. So we say, here's another twosome. It's black and white. And then let me give a better example. Let's say they have, blueness. Where would a person have blueness? Dreams of the blue sea and yellow catarrh. So we say, okay, the yellow catarrh and the blue sea, that's our position. Now, how does that fit into the throat chakra? Well, the blue relates to the throat chakra and the yellow relates to the abdominal chakra. So now we say, okay, we have these two things, the two colors and the throat chakra and the abdominal chakra. And then we may find, you know, that the most difficult part for them is always, let's say, difficulty arising in the morning and difficulty with the joints first movement, better continuous movement, and problems, you know, swallowing, we already said, and one more thing, and difficulty in childhood. They had some kind of abusive childhood or something like that. So now we say, okay, this is difficulty in the beginning because it's difficult first movement, difficulty in the morning, difficulty in childhood in the beginning. So we say these three things go together. It's difficulty beginning to move. So now we've got the two chakras. We've got the colors from the law of opposites. We've got laughing and crying from the law of opposites, those two oppositions. And we've got difficulty in the beginning, difficulty getting going on stuff. So now we've got a whole load of things that we can start to put together. These are still components using different systems. And now we can start to synthesize it into, you know, the throat is the beginning, that difficulty swallowing. And the case yellow and blue relates to the four elements, earth and water. And earth is always difficulty moving, difficulty beginning to move. So these things go together. So it's all the time matching and saying, okay, that one goes with that one, the other one goes with the other one, until you finally form a whole thing that you can express in one sentence. Problems with the throat and abdominal chakra, problems starting, and problems between earth and water, laughing and crying, something like that. And that can be refined even further. So that's just an example of kind of different approaches which I would knit together, weave together, and then I might bring something like Chinese medicine into it and see that, okay, maybe they have, together with that abdominal problem, maybe they have a weakness in the kidney. So then it might look like empty kidney disease, you know, of some kind. And these two would go together, the abdominal and the kidney, because they're more or less on the same chakra. So then I would see, and that tinnitus that they have relates to the Chinese system of empty kidney energy. So I would tie those two together and then try and bring that together with all the other factors. That's the kind of game that I play, using as many methodologies as possible. I might use the notes of the scale, you know, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. I might use a periodic table. I might use... I might use the Kabbalah system. I might use mathematics. I might use mythology. Anything I've got, I'm going to use, and I'm going to swim between all these different methodologies, picking out the appropriate one, and then trying to knit them together into one.
Very interesting, Jeremy. One of the
I just made that up off the top of my head. So
that was great.
Sorry
to put you on the spot like that.
Okay.
That's my job. So, one of the things that's very popular today, Jeremy, is this the use of botanical and zoological groupings, family groupings, and taxonomical groupings, or even groupings within, you know, series and stages of the periodic table. This is very much in vogue. I'd say it's probably the most, in my estimation, most popular way to practice these days among the majority of the community. So I'm curious, do you use this in your own practice, and what is your opinion of it?
Nah, I don't much. But you see, look, there's one method that I don't use, and that's the kingdom method, right?
Mm-hmm.
Much at all. Maybe, you know, a very small percentage occasionally. And it goes, you know, to a degree towards the botanicals. Now, I'm not saying throw the whole thing out, because there's a lot of good stuff in there. And it's what I said before, you know, there's good and there's bad in everything. I don't see things in black and white like that. But I see a lot of weakness in the general kingdom method of going mineral, animal, vegetable. I'd say that is definitely a weak link, because it's very simplistic, and I'm not talking about, you know, total signatures, because then people say, no, we go to the energy level and stuff like that. But I do not see the world dividing so cleanly and neatly into those kingdoms. you know, we're working in the world of potency here. We're working with high energies. And in the world of potencies, the minerals are, you know, mixed with the animals, mixed with the vegetables. It's not happening in a neat, categorized way like that. There are minerals that act as animals. There are plants that act as minerals. There are animals that act as plants. It's all in the high world of potency. All these things spiral together into, you know, a mix that is not to do with their classification, but is to do with the very way that they are, the essence of these substances, where, you know, chocolate can look like a hedgehog, you know, because they have the same essence. Chocolate has something of the hedgehog in it, and calcarea has something of the mouse or the rat in it, and marble has something of the cat in it, and diamond has something of the tiger in it. These things mesh together, and belladonna has something of the dog in it. So I don't like to make that classification, especially not early on in the case, because that's going to, that's, you know, you've already made a decision about your remedy way before you've understood what needs to be cured in the case. Now, when it comes to botanical classifications, you know, there's times to use it and there's times not to use it. And the same with mineral families, etc. Look, where I think it's good is you come up with a remedy, you know, some umbellifera remedy, and it's just not exactly fitting, and you say to yourself, okay, you know, which other of the umbellifera can fit this case? You know, should we look sideways a bit into them? And that can sometimes be useful. You know, what might seem, you know, to be a belladonna case, solanicea, might be a hyoscyamus, might be, you know, any other solanicea case. Or a veratrum case might turn out to be a sabadilla case because they belong to the liliacea, the same family. So it's good to use that because sometimes you repertorize and you come up with, you know, the polycrest that is best represented in the family, but it's not going to be that polycrest. It will be some other minor plant or mineral that is in the same family. That's fine. But to try and find, let's put it like this, one of the tricky points here, especially when it comes to botanicals that you mentioned, is that plant remedies are not made from the same part of the plants. So some remedies are made from roots, some are from leaves, some are from flowers, and that is definitely not the same. In fact, to my mind, from studying these remedies quite deeply, I think it actually matters as much, if not more, which part of the plant or the animal the remedy is made from. You know, when we say lacaninum, well, is it more milk or is it more dog? And I can go into the remedy, you know, symptom by symptom and symptom, and show that the majority of it is milk. If it's, you know, the white coating on the throat or you know, the swelling of the breast or stuff like that. But people tend to say this is dog. It would be very different from dog's hair. So we can't necessarily compare it to another animal from that family that we've used the hair or the tooth or the saliva from. And the same, you know, if you take phytolacca and compare it to other remedies in that group, but phytolacca is a root, and there's a big difference when you're proving the root or you're proving the leaf. And that makes those kind of classifications a bit shaky. But
Jeremy, I'm sorry to interject, but I'm so glad you brought this up, because for years now I've been thinking that it would be fantastic to study some extensive trials where we prove different parts of the same organism and really to determine how different the proving results would be.
Yeah, it's a very important thing. For instance, I'll give you an example. You know, I proved eagle's blood, and Divya proved eagle's feather. And now, it's not exactly the same eagle, but okay, you know, pretty relatively close, you know. But they're pretty different as it goes, you know. The blood is going to bring up its own energy, and the feather will bring up its own energy. So one has to be careful with making comparisons. But nevertheless, that's a technical point. Because
with regard to the proving of Divya's proving and your proving, how different would you say they are?
I'd give it, you know, 50% easily.
50% different.
Yeah, I'd say even more, you know, because in there, you know, you're going to get some flying elements. But on the other hand, you know, my eagle, the blood brings out a very syphilitic, dark energy. And the fact that eagle was, you know, a caged eagle, a wounded caged eagle, brings out another whole side of trapped and dark and despair and psychotic energy, which doesn't show in that feather, you know, eagle feather remedy. So in animals in particular, the personal history of the animal does definitely play a part. You know, which is less noticeable, of course, in plants and in minerals. But, you know, this is it's still a technical point because somebody could come and say, rightfully so, you know, so in 100 years, if we proved only the leaves of all lambeli feather, well, that argument wouldn't hold water. Yeah. And I'd have to say, yeah, you know, it wouldn't. It's just a technical issue, which is true for the moment. But there are other problems with classifications, and, you know, let me put it like that. There's a constant battle in homeopathy, a tug of war between totality and individuality. They both pull in different directions. Totality wants to generalize. It wants to say, you know, all these plants are one family. It wants to say if there's, in a Bonninghausen way, if they're burning pains in the knee, then there could be burning pains anywhere. And that's the totality aspect. It's trying to generalize and make big pictures out of things and say, okay, this whole period of the periodic table is one generalized concept. Now, individuality, on the other hand, is saying, no, these are different. These are strange, rare, peculiar, individual things. If there's burning in the knee, that does not equate to burning in the ear. If this, if Aurum Metallicum is in the sixth period, that does not mean that it has necessarily shared elements with Iridium. They are their own peculiar individuals. So the individual energy is pulling one way towards strange, rare, and peculiar uniqueness, and the totality is trying to make us all one whole. And the homeopath has to play with both those energies. They have to all the time be comparing totality and individuality and trying to harmonize the two of those, that right brain, left brain game. So when we go towards classifications of kingdoms, of botanical, of a periodic table, of, you know, seeing the big picture, we're pulling strongly towards one way, but then we might lose the individuality of the proving of what makes it unique. If we go too much to the individuality of the proving and only the strange and peculiar, it becomes keynote prescribing. So one has to find that delicate balance between those two. It's a game between those two energies, which shows everywhere, all the way across the homeopathic board and the homeopathic game, really. So that's why I say, you know, keep those things in balance. If you start off only from the generals, you're going to lose that individual proving energy. And, you know, that's it, more or less.
Jeremy, I want to switch course a little bit and ask you a little bit about your project in your AIDS project in Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing in Tanzania?
Well, you know, this has been a very long-term project for me, Kim. I've been working on it over the last 10 years, I would say, you know, kind of preparing for it and getting ready for it and you know, choosing different paths and going down them and having great big disappointments on the way. You know, lots of disappointments for the first 8 years of doing this, you know, trying to get research, trying to find partners in Africa, trying to raise funds, mostly together with Tina Quirk, who helped me all along the way on this. And you know, we just, it was like hitting your head against the wall, trying to get a research going, try to raise funds to get an African partner, which is absolutely necessary. And after all this time, I just said, you know, forget it. I'm just going to get up and I'm going to go there and start working, and the energy is going to happen from there. You can't get it ready by remote control. So I did that, you know, in nearly coming up to 2 years soon, and I moved out there, and my family followed me, and my wife is a great homeopath, Camilla, and we just started working in clinics. You know, we'd come to a village, and we'd say, you know, here we are, do you want us to work? And they'd say, you know, when can you start? They'd give us a tree, or they'd give us a room, or, you know, they'd give us place behind a shop somewhere, and we'd just sit down there, and the patients would start coming and, you know, fill up in no time. And the results there are astoundingly amazing because, you know, I've, like you said, I've been working many years in the West, and I've never seen results that are so fast and so dramatic as I've seen in Africa. You know, people just get better within a week, however severe the, you know, in severe cases of AIDS. And, you know, there's a very high level of success there with classical homeopathy. So, you know, we are working out in small villages, you know, which we have to drive, you know, for an hour and a half to sometimes where nobody comes and there's not much help there. A lot of AIDS patients. And we have about, you know, 7 or 8 different locations that we work in, and the word of mouth has spread, and the local people are extremely happy with homeopathy. They like them. It fits the way they think. They see that it's, you know, very affordable. Well, we don't charge anything, but there are no side effects. And more than anything, they see that it, you know, it treats the whole person, and it treats the spirit and the dreams, which is very important to them. That's the way they're used to thinking. So they like it very much, and we welcome wherever we go. You know, I've had many requests from different villages to work there, and I've had, you know, hospitals approaching me to work there. And the doctors, they don't have this kind of mindset like doctors have in the West. You know, this is the kind of medicine they know, and all the rest is bad. They're very open and very welcoming to homeopathy. They don't have any prejudice about it. And when they see that it works, and it does work, then they say, you know, bring it on board. And some of them want to study it as well. We've got some courses going now. We're teaching local people homeopathy, and we have various other projects on the side because there's a lot of extreme poverty and there's a lot of hunger there. And we saw that, you know, however good you prescribe, and patients kind of get better from the remedies, but if they're hungry, then you know, they're still going to be sick. So we've initiated some food projects. We've got some gardens going where we grow vegetables and chickens and stuff. And there was another problem with a you know, most of the patients we treat are widows, AIDS widows, where the husband has died. You know, it seems that the husband often dies first. Maybe because they got it first or for various other local social reasons. So we see 80% of AIDS widows, and they usually have 3 or 4 kids. Some of them might be infected with AIDS, and there's a severe poverty problem. I mean, real poverty where they might not have eaten for 2 or 3 days. And usually these mothers are extremely weak. They can't go out and work. They don't have the energy. That's one of the main symptoms of AIDS. And when we treat them, they get better pretty quickly. You know, in a week or two, they're able to get up. They're able to go to work. But then there's a problem. You know, they just go out and they to work in the field and leave the kids at home. There's nobody to look after them. So we opened a daycare center for kids of our AIDS patients where we feed them 2 meals a day, and they're playing and they're getting a good education, and we try and get them clothes and stuff like that. I also bring over, you know, glasses, eyesight glasses, you know, for patients because that's a big problem there. AIDS often affects the vision badly and they can't see properly, and of course they can't afford glasses. So we do all kinds of projects on the side, teaching homeopathy, trying to help people where we can. But, of course, the main thrust is practicing homeopathy. The results are very good, both in terms of symptoms and in terms of reducing side effects of conventional treatment. We do not take people off conventional medication, and we see it as an integrated approach. We try and help them with the symptoms, with the side effects. Most of them are on medication. And, you know, that is one of the great things because the problem is they can, you know, these medications, antiretrovirals, have a limited time span. And after 2 or 3 years, in some cases earlier than that, they will stop working and they can go into treatment failure, and there aren't any other options after that. Now, by reducing side effects, we can actually help them, you know, to deal with it for a longer time, and in that way, the conventional medicine and the authorities appreciate what we do, and they see it as a very positive and good thing. We're getting very good results in terms of, you know, lab results, blood count, where it can be obtained, CD4 and viral load. And our aim is to make homeopathy accessible to as many patients as possible, make it a self-sustainable thing so that, you know, one day when we go home, homeopathy will continue and will spread out through Africa. We continuously working, you know, I'm looking at it from the larger totality of epidemic and looking for remedies of the general of the genus epidemicus so that it's easier to treat and easier to pass on the knowledge to other people. And that's it. You know, it's hard work. It's a demanding project. There are a lot of difficulties living in Africa. There are also a lot of joy living in Africa. It's a very powerful place, you know, and the people are great. So, you know, we like everywhere, it's got its great things and it's got its problems, like no electricity, you know, no internet often, mosquitoes, that kind of things. And everything breaks down all the time. But, you know, it's so nice to treat the people, to see the results, to see their appreciation, and we get a lot out of it. And professionally, it's a big challenge for me to deal with it from an epidemic point of view.
Wow, you know, that's unbelievably exciting. And, Jeremy, I would also just like to acknowledge the incredible trials and tribulations you've gone through to start and implement this project. So really, you know, kudos to you for doing this. I will ask you a little bit later where people can financially support your project there. But before I do that, I'm curious, what have you found in Africa to be some of the most important criteria that lead to successful prescribing in these types of cases? And also, Jeremy, have you found that the case analysis work you're doing in Africa is different than what you found you were doing in Europe and the rest of the world? And is that, and how has that been, if that's the case, has that been helpful to you in any way?
I would say it's pretty different. The kind of cases we see there are very different from what you would see in the West, from what I'm used to seeing in the West, because they are what people would term, you know, one-sided cases. You get very general, very vague symptoms, physical symptoms and general symptoms. There are no modalities. You know, when somebody has a headache, they usually not going to express what makes it better or worse or anything like that, or very difficult for them to describe what kind of pain it is. So you end up with a case that is, you know, it is headache, weakness, diarrhea, fever, and pains in the joints. That's what you've got from your generals and physicals. There's certainly no desires and aversions for food. You know, it's pretty ridiculous to ask them what they like to eat when they're all going hungry. And, you know, you know, you don't... And the same goes for all the mental emotionals. There's none of that, the mental and emotional elaborate pictures that you get out of people in the West where, you know, I would say that, you know, what I've learned is that in the West, people's energy is very much trapped in their heads. You know, people think a lot, people feel a lot, they self-examine themselves a lot, and they've got a whole load of mental emotion symptoms, which when you work in Africa for a while, you see that these you know, big and elaborate pictures of people in the West is often a lot of candy floss, if you know what I mean. Mm. It's just smokescreen of things going round and round and round. You know, it's interesting because in Swahili, the word for white people is mzungu. And it has various meanings, but one of the meanings is the people that go around in circles. And that's what you learn to see because, you know, when you take a mental picture there, usually you just get, I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm angry. You know, it's going to be one of those. know, or some theme like that. There's going to be none of this two-hour stuff that you get in the West. And, you know, you can ask about fears, and, you know, the fears are all realistic. If they say, I'm scared of snakes and leopards, it's because there's snakes and leopards around.
Right.
So, you know, you don't get that kind of autoimmune mental chronic stuff that we used to. So there's no big mentals. Maybe you'll get one or two. The physicals are very generalized. No modalities, no strange or peculiar. If you're going to approach it with one of the fancy new methods, you're going to fall right on your face. It's not going to happen. You know, you have to adapt yourself to a different kind of homeopathy, which I would basically, you know, define as a Bunninghausen approach, meaning that, you know, you're going to take those big general symptoms and put them together, and now you still have to choose between 40 or 50 remedies. However, you're going to find that one nugget, that one cherry of a strange, rare, or peculiar individual symptom in each case. And that's where you have to get sophisticated. Usually it might be in the dreams, which are very important for the local people. You know, they pay a lot of store by their dreams. They're used to expressing through the dreams. And that's where it gets sophisticated. You know, you may have one dream, and you have to take that dream and then match that dream to the rest of the totality and see how the whole thing ticks. And that's where, you know, you'll be able to choose your remedy from the 40, 50 remedies that have come out from the big general picture. And that's how we work usually. You know, we'll take that big Bunninghausen approach of big general symptoms, and then we'll look for that one individual symptom that is going to, you know, pick the right remedy out of that. It takes a degree of sophistication in homeopathy. You know, the homeopaths that have visited us, they've been quite, you know, astounded by what we're doing and what we managed to get out of those cases. And at the same time, we're using the epidemic information that we are building up in terms of not only remedies, but a deeper understanding of what the whole AIDS thing is about, which is a huge enigma and picture to work on. But generally, we'll be able to use that and pick out a remedy that, you know, in most of the cases is working very, very well. And classical homeopathy is amazing. You know, it just works great over there. So it's doable, but it's very different. And if I've learned anything, you know, it's, you know, I've always been careful with, you know, the mind. I've always said the mind is a minefield. You know, we've got to use the mind, but it can get very confusing, and you can go out, you know, down all kinds of little pathways and that are going to lead you astray and get you lost in over-hashing the mental symptoms. And working in Africa shows it up very clearly.
Very interesting. And, you know, Jeremy, it's interesting that you're using Bunninghausen's approach, because I don't know if you remember the quote, but he had some criticism of Materia Medica, which was very similar to what you expressed, which is that he felt that it was overly romantic in its description and overly detailed, that it was correct in its essential points, but overly elaborately detailed in a romantic way. That's essentially exactly what you said, so I thought that was very, very interesting. Jeremy, I want to give people an opportunity to ask some questions as well, but before I do that, just quickly, are you offering any programs, study programs in Tanzania for people outside of the country to come and study with you, or...?
Yes, we do. We offer study programs, you know, for four or five people. You know, we try and make a group, but we can get people from different countries together, of course. And, you know, we have a sitting-in program where people can sit, you know, sit in with us for 2 weeks, see 7 or 8 full days of clinic, and then do teaching and go into the various aspects of the philosophy and the Materia Medica of what's happening. And on top of that, we organize a nice safari because it's great safari country out there. You can see the best. Yeah.
So
if you're interested, just write to, you know, one of my addresses.
Jeremy, can you give us the information, email or other information where people can either provide financial support or find out about studying with you in Tanzania?
Okay. Well, you can go to www.homeopathyforhealth.com. In Africa, that's one word, homeopathy for health in Africa, org, and that's our website. It's and you know, you'll get some details over there. It might need a bit of updating on the visitors information, but you'll get our addresses there, and you can write to us. You'll also see have a look you know, at all our email addresses at www.dynamis.edu, short for education, dynamis.edu. And there, if you're in the States, you know, you can send an email or call up Tina Quirk, and she handles things for us there, and we'll pass on all the relevant information. And as they say in Swahili, karibu, which means, you know, welcome, we'd love to see you, we enjoy people coming over. There is a different track, which is, you know, people who want to come over as volunteers to actually prescribe there. And we have we've had one volunteer, Eric Pettigrew from New York, was there for 3 months, and we've now got Vivian Freud there. That's just started working there. She's come over for 3 months, so that's a 3 month option, you know, to really get stuck into it. We'll give you your own clinic, your own village, 2 weeks of training. And away you go. You're going to see a lot of patients and learn a lot, I would say. You know, the people who have been there so far have learned a lot out of that experience.
Fantastic. Let me also, before I open it up for some questions, let me also mention that Jeremy is going to be offering a 5-week webinar course starting July 25th and running through September 19th. So that's going to be starting fairly soon. It's a 5-week course. It's interactive, multimedia rich, and also Jeremy will actually be working on participants' cases. So there'll be paper cases, but there'll also people will have the opportunity to submit their own cases, and some of those will actually be selected to be discussed during the actual course time. So again, it's a 5-week course. Early bird still is in effect, and that will be starting on July 25th and running through September 22nd, and that runs every other week. All right, so let me, if you want more information, you can go to the Whole Health Now website, and you'll find the information about that, or you'll get emails from us. All right, let me open it up and see if anybody has questions for Jeremy. Questions for Jeremy?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
This is Mary Freya from Penn Valley.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Oh, I'm totally thrilled to hear you and this chakra system, because I work with that all the time, and now I'll have some way to kind of incorporate it into homeopathy.
Wait, did you have a question or just a comment?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a comment.
that was
an appreciation comment.
Do you have a question as well?
I appreciate the appreciation, and you know, I think it's exciting because there's lots of systems, you know, that we use in our lives. You know, if it's Tai Chi or if it's yoga or if it's music or mathematics or movies that we can incorporate into homeopathy. Homeopathy is big enough to take all these things up and use them. So, you know, I'm pleased when it hits a personal note. That's what it's about.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Good. Any other questions for Jeremy Scherer? We've got a few minutes.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Issa, and along the same lines with the chakra, thank you for that, because I also work with that a lot. My question to you is there any form of study that you could point us toward in regard to books or classes or anything that could give us more speaking about? I work intuitively primarily, but it would be else you could suggest.
Kim, can you help me out on that one?
Well, is she just asking for general recommendations for books on homeopathy or to a specific area?
I think she's saying, you know, the reason I'm asking you first is because you're more acquainted with the books that have come out recently.
Yeah.
Because, you see, in terms of case analysis, there are not many books that go that way, that actually explain to you how you're going to analyze by sevens or by twos or by fives or anything like that. It's, you know... nobody's actually put that together, although you get snippets in different books, as far as I know. So it's a matter of taking that tool that you used to doing using in your own life, and seeing how you can adapt it into homeopathy. And somebody has to write that book, unless they have, Kim, have they?
Not that I know of, but perhaps this is something for you to do for the future.
Listen, I'm in the middle of writing 4 books right now, but I tend to spread myself wide on it. But I would say, you know, I do have another book that you haven't mentioned, Kim, and that's my syphilis book, The Materia Medica of Syphilis.
Yes.
And what I do in that book is I do try to show different methods of analysis, you know, but not, I don't spell it out easily. It means I've kind of made it like a difficult case that you have to unravel by yourself. The whole book is one totality of many riddles, and you need to use these different concepts in order to put it together. So if you don't find another suitable book, chew on my syphilis book.
It's a very poetic book as well, very poetic work, really.
Poetry is one method of analysis. It's one way we can approach a case. But otherwise, you know, when you're studying with these various systems that, you know, we all, maybe you're into the five elements, or maybe you're into the I Ching or anything like that, think, how do I bring that into homeopathy? And think on a practical level, not just the intuitive level, meaning how do I repertorize with this, you know? How's this going to help me choose a rubric? How's it going to help me choose a remedy? How will I analyze and synthesize a case with that? So you're going to have to do a bit of thinking work, but that's the fun of the game.